Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. Now today for me, and I imagine for many of you, it's a very, very special day. The 17th of March every year, I wake with a song in my heart, with the music of the harps resounding in my ears, with the laughter of children, because it is, of course, Tom Holland, our favourite day. It's St Patrick's Day, isn't it?
It is a day in which we celebrate a great British saint.
Very good. So Tom, St Patrick's Day, everybody all over the world sort of knows or thinks they know. We all think we know what happened with St. Patrick. So to sort of to give you the kind of caricatured version, you know, the Roman Empire falls, the Dark Ages, an age of obscurantism and violence and stuff. I know you don't agree with that, so don't interrupt. So that descends. And then St. Patrick, in my mind, probably wrongly, I've always thought of him as a Welshman or maybe a Cumbrian. Goes over to Ireland, he kicks out the snakes, converts them all to Christianity.
Three-leaf clover.
Yeah, the shamrocks involved.
Yeah.
He comes to and fro, there's pirates, there's all kinds of amusing shenanigans. He dies, tremendous figure for Ireland, everyone loves him. Later
Guinness.
On, they start having parades
parties.
In America. Yeah, it's all people wearing those sort of terrible comedy beards and green hats. And actually, a lot of Irish people find that immensely patronising and annoying. But that, to me, and I think to most people listening to this, is their image of St. Patrick. Now, am I right in thinking, I believe I am, that this is largely balderdash?
Well, there are certain trace elements of fact in that.
Right.
But it's a complicated story, but it's fascinating for everything that makes it complex.
Okay. So Patrick did exist.
Patrick definitely existed, but there may, for instance, have been two Patricks.
Oh, that's so exciting.
That's just one of the many ambiguities, the ambivalences, the uncertainties, the paradoxes that surround and constitute the story of the historical.
It's all
Patrick.
About paradoxes with you, Tom, as always
it
on
is.
This podcast.
Yeah.
But before we get into all that, there is something else that is absolutely sensational and spectacularly exciting about this episode, Tom, because do you know what today also marks?
Is it, by any chance, our very first specially sponsored episode?
It is. Now, we're no, listeners will know, we are absolutely no strangers to promotional activities. We make no apology for it.
We love it.
We can't get enough of it. And if people want to encourage more such activities, they are very welcome to do so. Now, our friends at Beer 52, who regular listeners will remember, they are offering a free case, Tom, of 8 Irish beers for St. Patrick's Day. And do you know what? They have sent some for us to try.
Which is brilliant, because we're recording this at 10 o'clock in the morning. So it's like being at the airport.
Yes, but it's much better than going to a Wetherspoons. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
It absolutely is. So, I think we should celebrate this sponsorship, Dominic, by toasting the morning.
Yeah, top of the morning.
And try one.
Yeah, very good.
So we have one here. It's from Sligo's White Hag.
Are you on that White Hag?
Brilliant name.
So I'm three deep already, Tom. I'm on, I've moved
your
on
new Eng- to- the New England IPA.
I've moved in. No, I've moved on to the Oh Brother Brewing Milk Stout. Very tasty. You can go to beer52.com/Ireland to claim your free case. You only have to pay for the postage, which is £5.95.
So that's beer52.com/Ireland.
So, Tom, while you're sipping your beer, we have to get into the topic, the thorny issue of St. Patrick. And we've had lots of questions from our listeners about this. And basically, the question they all want to know is, who is St. Patrick and did he really exist? So, off you go.
He did exist. And this is precisely what makes the topic so interesting. So, Dominic, we did an episode on King Arthur.
Yeah.
And we talked about how it is perhaps legitimate to talk about the 5th and 6th centuries in Britain and even more Ireland as being a dark age, in the sense that we know nothing about it, really. We don't have very many sources for it. However, what we have with Patrick is someone who wrote not one, but two pieces of writing that shed a kind of glimmering faint light on the otherwise complete darkness of this period in terms of the written sources. And so he is a figure of enormous significance, not just for the history of Britain and Ireland, but actually for the whole study of the collapse of the Roman Empire and the period that Peter Brown, the great historian, called Late Antiquity. Right. So in a sense, we also did an episode on Muhammad. You could situate Patrick in the same kind of world that gives rise to Muhammad. He is a holy man in an age when people are very prone to showing respect for holy men. And what these holy men do is that they tend to go to regions, to areas that are kind of remote from where they've grown up. So if you think of Muhammad leaving Mecca, going to Medina, you think of monks going from kind of settled regions out into the wilds, into the deserts. The story of Patrick is that he goes from Roman Britain, a Roman settlement, and he goes to the wild barbarism, as it seems to him, of Ireland. And this is part of a kind of a churn that will help to facilitate the transformation of the Roman world into the early medieval world. And I think it's a completely fascinating topic. I mean, having flagged that up, I then have to say that it's also a complex topic.
You're going to qualify what you've said.
Yeah, because again, as with Muhammad, we talked about this, that the stories that are told of Muhammad several centuries later may not necessarily map onto the reality of the historical Muhammad. The same is true with Patrick. So we do have these very, very kind of early texts written by him. But then, of course, we have subsequent traditions, subsequent accounts, and the question of how reliable they are as evidence for the historical Patrick is an absolutely live issue.
It's very like the story of James Callaghan, Tom. Now,
yes, mythic figure.
Let's get to the nitty gritty. So, when do we think St. Patrick is born? When and where? Am I right in thinking he is a late antique Melvin Bragg?
Well, so does he come from Cumbria? Let's look at the two pieces of writing. The key one really is his Confessio, which isn't exactly a confession. It's a kind of an account of his life.
Yeah.
Infuriatingly, from the point of view of the historian, a substantial proportion of this is kind of woven. It's a tapestry woven out of fragments of the Bible. So there are kind of like almost 400 biblical allusions in it.
Yeah.
And that is the focus for Patrick. And the biographical details are relevant only insofar as they sustain his sense, you know, they help him to explain his sense of mission and his understanding of Christ. However, there are clues. So what he says is that his grandfather, Potitus, was a priest, a presbyter, and that his father, Calpurnius, was a deacon. So again, a kind of a priest within the church, but also a decurion. Which is a kind of, he sits on the curia, which is the local town or city council. Yeah. So what he's describing there is the infrastructure of Roman Britain.
And Tom, just to quickly jump in, this is at a point when Christianity is the state religion at this point?
Yeah, it's in the aftermath of Constantine's conversion. Christianity has definitely spread to Britain.
Yeah.
How far is much debated, and the evidence of Patrick's life is kind of sheds a light on that perhaps. But what we see there certainly is that Patrick, so Patricia, his name, Patricius, you know, it's patrician. It's a Roman word, redolent of kind of nobility. So he's upper class.
Yeah.
His father and his grandfather are figures of moment. They are part of the civic government of Roman Britain, but they are also figures within the church. And so that suggests the way in which church and the kind of the civic structure of cities is starting to meld and mesh.
They're sort of interwoven, yeah.
Yeah, and civic government in cities, you know, is basically dependent on the existence of a broader provincial, Roman provincial structure. So the implication is that he's born into a province that is still Roman.
Okay, because I just wanted to pick up on that, because when we did our When Did the Roman Empire Fall podcasts a few weeks ago, there was a sense that Britain was slightly semi-detached as you entered the 5th century. But you're sort of saying that the life of St. Patrick implies that Roman structures are still actually very deeply embedded. And if this is Cumbria, you know, it's a long way from Rome. I mean, it's a long way from the... Well, maybe it's not Cumbria. Are you going
to
tell
me? It does. It implies that there are offices that people take on local city councils or town councils. Patrick's father has land. He has slaves. So this is very much still a slave-owning property society. This does not seem to be a land that is collapsing into anarchy and barbarism. So there are implications that Roman civic life is continuing to function. So presumably this is either the late 4th century or the first decade of the 5th century. Now, the question of where it is, and there's been a number of questions on that, haven't there? Father Darren J. Zainal, I've heard claims he's from several different places. Where is he really from? Okay, so what Patrick tells us is that he's from a place called Banavem Taberniae. Taberniae is kind of shops, you know, taverns. It's places that sell things. Banavem, we can't be certain where that is. So there have been various theories. One of them is that it's a fort that was known to the Romans as Banna, a horn in Celtic, on Hadrian's Wall, now known as Burd Oswald. Another theory is that it's Carlisle, which was a kind of a civic centre just south of Hadrian, well, pretty much on Hadrian's Wall, actually.
Yeah.
However, there's a problem there, which you put your finger on, which is that this is indeed a very, very remote kind of frontier region. And so far as we know, there are no villas. There's no evidence for any villas that far north. So that would imply that Patrick wasn't, in fact, I think, from Cumbria. There's another theory, which is a much later one, which is that he came from Glastonbury.
That seems a bit too good to be true, Tom.
It does. Also that he's buried there.
Right.
So that wouldn't go down well with Irish listeners, exactly like King Arthur. And this is a tradition that's first mentioned by William of Malmesbury, or at least by people who've rewritten William of Malmesbury in the 12th century, but it seems to date back to the 10th century at least. Again, unlikely. I would have thought that the likeliest place is probably Caerleon. That would be the one that I would go for, which is the fort of the legions in Wales. It's the great legionary centre. There would definitely have been Taberniae kind of scattered around it, even after the legions had gone. It's within striking distance of the coast, and that's important because, as Patrick goes on to say, he gets captured by pirates and taken away to Ireland.
So it's clearly on the west coast is clearly the obvious place, isn't it?
It must be on the west coast. I mean, there is an 8th century tradition that he was born in Strathclyde, so that's beyond Hadrian's Wall.
King Arthur.
Yeah, again, so he's kind of shifting. But unlike King Arthur, we actually, you know, we don't have first-hand evidence from Arthur himself. No. So we can't even say that Arthur existed. But Patrick, we can.
Although, Tom, the St. Patrick of legend and the St. Patrick of history are two very different beasts. And some historians, maybe I'm jumping ahead, think that there are multiple different people whose lives have found their way into this sort of the canonical story of St. Patrick, don't they?
So we'll come to that. But if we stick for now to what Patrick himself tells us, and then we can ask, first of all, how credible Patrick's own account is, and then how it may have been distorted in subsequent decades.
Ironically, I have to say the one place we know he didn't come from was Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, so he is British and he's Roman.
Yeah.
And he self-identifies as both.
Okay.
He's a Roman citizen. He confesses that as a young man, he wasn't a particularly good Christian. Age 15, he seems to have done something very naughty. for which he gets put on trial.
Do we know what? No suspicion at all, Tom?
He doesn't say what it was.
Mind boggles. Glue something behind there.
Yeah, behind the bus shelter. Then shortly after this, he gets taken by pirates as a slave, he says. And he gets taken, he gets sold. He becomes a herdsman, so looking after cattle, probably, in the forest of Falkland, he says, which I gather maybe is probably County Mayo. Learns Irish. His Christian faith deepens there. And then one day, 6 years after his abduction, he hears a voice. And this voice says to him, "You have fasted well. Soon you must return to your native land." And then shortly afterwards, again, this voice says, "The ship is ready to take you." However, there's a catch, because the voice also says that it's not nearby, but 200 miles away.
Right. And the voice gives and the voice takes away.
The voice, because to be a slave, you know, a runaway slave in Ireland is very dangerous.
Right.
Because Ireland is a place where you have to belong essentially to the equivalent of a kind of a gang. You know, there are all these little monarchies, which again are subordinate to larger monarchies and so on. But basically, if you don't belong, if you don't have an overlord who can give you protection, you're in real danger. But especially if you're a runaway slave. Right. So the idea that Patrick has made it 200 miles to where this ship is supposedly waiting for him, the implication is that there is the quality of the miraculous to this. So it's probably not to be taken as just a documentary fact.
I was about to ask about all this, though, Tom. I mean, the captured by the pirates could have happened. The voice, I think, as secular historians, we would probably say he didn't get a voice telling him that the ship was 200 miles away. Also, the capture by pirates is very biblical. It's very Julius Caesar. It's entrenched in kind of fables and stuff.
It is. So we'll come to that when we ask how accurate the account is. So Patrick, he arrives, he finds the ship. They refuse to take him on. And he specifies something very interesting, which has provoked a lot of speculation. He says he refuses to suck the breasts of the people on the ship.
Okay, that's an unexpected development.
Yes, it
Who's
is.
Who's on the ship? That's the question.
So what does this mean? So there are scholars who have argued that if you're in Ireland and you don't have an overlord to look after you, you can gain the protection of a lord by sucking his nipple.
I don't know what to say about that.
So, you know, you're traveling through Ireland, you're on holiday, but everywhere you go, you have to suck the nipple of the local bigwig. That's the implication. And the archaeological evidence for this is that in 2003, two men were found in different bogs in Ireland. They were clearly aristocratic. Their hands were, you know, they weren't rough. They weren't peasants. They were clearly aristocrats. Both men had had their nipples surgically removed.
Why would you have it surgically? Because you were sick of people sucking it.
Probably to stop them being kings is the implication. So you can't offer people the nipple.
That is so weird.
Well, it is weird. And so the other theory is that it's an allusion to a biblical verse. So there's a verse in Isaiah, "You shall suck the milk of the Gentiles." So perhaps that's what
Patrick that's sort of more banal, but probably but a bit more persuasive, I would say, than this business about doing a road trip and having to
suck nipples.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's something for the Irish tourist authorities, perhaps, to...
Why don't they make more play of that? I mean, madness.
I know. There's a whole advertising campaign there. Yeah. Anyway, so basically the people on the ship decide that actually they are going to let him come with them. They sail for 3 days. They land. They then journey for 28 days through a wilderness. The food runs out. They turn around and say, "I thought that you were meant to be a chosen one of God. What's going on?" And miraculously, a herd of pigs arrive. So they kill the pigs and have a massive barbecue.
That almost certainly happened. Yeah.
They then journey for another 10 days. Mm-hmm. And presumably he then arrives at his parents' house or whatever. Doesn't actually specify where he's turned up.
Right.
But the best thing is that he says that this is 60 days, but obviously 3 days on the ship,
yeah,
28 days going through the wilderness, further 10 days, that doesn't count to 60 days. And so do you know what Roy Fletchner, who's written the most recent study of Patrick's life.
I'm not as familiar with Roy Fletchner's work as I should be.
Well, he's got a brilliant theory as to what Patrick, you know, why Patrick says 60 when it doesn't add up to 60.
Right.
Patrick was simply not very good at maths.
Oh, wow.
So it's a brilliant passage. He goes through all the kind of biblical reasons, perhaps, you know, is he, you know, 40 days? But yeah. He says, basically, there aren't any, you know, this isn't something you can get from the Bible. And he says, maybe he just wasn't very good at maths. Which,
that's a very literal approach to Patrick's story, I would say. Not that I'm dissing Roy Fletchner.
No. Yeah. He's very, very alert to the kind of the biblical context for it. But I think it's an interesting and, I thought, an engaging. Well, because this is very much Patrick's own writing. Maybe he just wasn't very good at adding things up. You know,
I think someone would have proofread it, though, like a copy editor or something. Right, anyway, so he's come back.
So he comes back, and then the next thing we know, he's about 45, and he's become a bishop.
That's a leap, yeah.
And he's hanging out in Britain again.
Yeah.
And while he's with his parents back in Britain, he sees a vision of a man called Victoricus. And this man, Victoricus, and nobody has the faintest idea who he is, seems to be coming from Ireland with lots of letters. And all these letters, when he reads them, are written by people from Ireland saying, please come over and we beg you, come and walk among us again.
Right. And but hold on. How would people remember him? I mean,
It's a vision. It's a
vision. Oh, okay. Fine.
It's a vision. Yep. And when you read it, you get this sense of incredible kind of intensity. This is... You know, he's seeing this, he's struggling to put it into words what exactly it is he saw, but it's this kind of incredible sense that God wants him to go and preach beyond the Irish Sea in this land that had never been a part of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the epitome of barbarism for generations of Roman geographers.
And Roman Britain is still going at this point. He's 45.
Britain by this point must have.
As I was about to say, we must be post kind of 410 or whatever by now.
Yeah.
But enough of Roman society survives that he hasn't been troubled by anarchy or something, and he's happy to make this journey off to Ireland to carry the gospel.
He doesn't tell us anything about his life in Britain.
Okay.
Presumably he's staying with his... So one thing we can know is that when he crosses to Ireland, he clearly takes quite a lot of movable goods with him,
right,
which enables him to kind of cut a dash, you know, so he's a figure of some moment.
Yeah.
And he tells us that he gets thousands of converts, that he gets the sons of various Irish kings converting, their daughters becoming nuns. The Irish kings don't seem to have liked the daughters becoming nuns. They don't seem to have particularly objected to the sons becoming Christian. And it may be that they're kind of, you know, hedging their bets, that they're staying pagan, their sons are becoming Christian.
Their daughters are maybe more important tools for kind of marriage alliances or something. And they don't want to, you know, them becoming nuns is a bit of a pain in that. Or nuns allowed to get married at this point?
It's probably. No, they're not.
Okay.
He gives us this portrait of an island that has been won by his missionary efforts for Christ, that it's a church full of missionary zeal. Now, this dovetails with the other piece of writing that has survived, which is a letter that he's written to a man called Caroticus, who seems to be a Romano-British slave trader.
Okay.
And he has crossed the Irish Sea from Britain and has abducted a load of Irish converts, probably on Easter Day, and taken them off as slaves. And Patrick is writing, basically excommunicating him.
Yeah.
Telling Caroticus that he's, you know, an absolute rotter and to hand over the slaves. It seems from the letter that that this isn't very successful. And that Caroticus and his followers just kind of laugh at the very idea that they should.
Right.
But Patrick in this letter, you get a sense of this, you know, the power of the holy man.
Yeah.
His power to curse those who oppose him.
Can I ask you a question? Can I jump in now, Tom? You say the power of the holy man. So Peter Brown, who you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, one of the greatest living historians, one of his early works was about the holy man in late antiquity. And he was talking particularly about holy men in the Eastern Roman Empire and Syria and so on. Does Patrick, do you think, play the same part as being the holy man who comes in and is a kind of arbiter and is a he stands apart from the traditional power structures and therefore is able to kind of exert a different kind of authority and so on, do you think?
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. And I'm sure that for reasons that we can't be certain about, he clearly has a kind of charisma that derives from his claims to a supernatural power.
Yeah.
And it may be that he brings a kind of a sense of the power of Rome, but not in such a way as to seem kind of overtly threatening of the independence of the various Irish kings, but a sense that there is a kind of a greater dimension beyond Ireland that perhaps that the Irish can become a part of.
So I was going to ask about that, because in the previous podcast, we did you know, a very timely podcast about the Vikings in the East and the sort of the origin stories of Russia and Ukraine. And one of those stories was about Vladimir the Great and his conversion to Byzantine Orthodoxy. And obviously one reason Vladimir does that is because it's political. He wants to ally himself with the great superpower of the Eastern Mediterranean. But the Irish conversion, I mean, if the Roman Empire is dwindling and if Roman power is breaking up in Britannia, in a sense, what's in it for them in following Patrick? I mean, what does Patrick have to offer? And also, Tom, am I not right in thinking, I mean, I'm just basically easily swayed by the questions from our listeners. Tony Larkin has a question. He says, why doesn't Patrick get the credit for introducing Christianity to Ireland when it seems there were previous missions? So
right.
Is Patrick the first? And why does he in particular have this? Because what's the sort of political subtext to his kind of conversion story?
Okay. It is true that this is to plunge into the kind of the heart of some of the puzzles that surround what Patrick tells us. So what is Patrick doing in his confessio, in this account of his life? I mean, it is a biography. It is a kind of self-exculpation. He's being attacked by people. He's trying to defend himself against kind of various charges that are never quite stated. So that's absolutely part of it as well. But it is, as I said at the beginning, it is absolutely a statement of mission. Mm-hmm. It's a sense that he's been called by Christ to take the gospel to lands beyond the Roman world. Now, the questioner is absolutely right that he is not alone in going to Ireland, it seems, because there is another figure who has not at all kind of entered the mainstream of Irish folklore or Catholic piety, a guy called Palladius. Whereas we have no contemporary references to Patrick outside his writings, with Palladius we don't have his writings, but we do have references to him in authenticated chronicles of the time. So he's mentioned by a guy called Prosper of Aquitaine in who's writing kind of annals of the years as they go by. And Prosper, he's right in his, he's in Aquitaine, so he's distant from Ireland, but he writes in 431 that in that year, Palladius, who had been consecrated by Pope Celestine, is sent as the first bishop to the Irish believers in Christ. So what's the relationship of Palladius and Patrick?
Are they the same person?
Well, so this was the argument that a scholar called Thomas Francis O'Rahilly in 1942 put forward. And his theory was that there was the Patrick that we know, the guy who's written the Confessio, but that Palladius was also, he was a patrician, so he was Palladius Patricius, and that he was the first guy to go there.
Yeah.
So that's the thesis, and it's a thesis that remains kind of very, very current. But I think there is a telling difference between Palladius and Patrick, which is that Prosper says of Palladius that he's sent to the Irish to the Irish believers in Christ who are already in Ireland. So presumably those are slaves, British slaves perhaps, Gallic slaves who've been taken to Ireland. And Celestine himself, the Pope who's sending Palladius, had specified that bishops should only go to places where they're wanted. And so what you have there is an echo of the assumption that was absolutely hardwired into the Romans and preceded the conversion of the empire to Christianity, that the fruits of Roman civilization should not wantonly be bestowed on barbarians. And the kind of the Christian manifestation of that is the assumption that Christianity is for people within the limits of the empire.
Right.
So this is something that is being, so Augustine, the saint who we talked about in the episode on the fall of the empire, the great bishop of Hippo in North Africa, who is essentially arguing why it doesn't really matter that Rome falls, because ultimately what matters is that the church survives. He is starting to, he's kind of groping his way towards an idea that the Christian mission is for everybody. It's for people beyond the limits of the empire, yes, as well as for those within. But he doesn't kind of quite arrive at the conclusion that you get with Patrick. Because the key thing about Patrick is, and this is the Patrick of the Confessio, the guy who we've been talking about, his assumption is that the gospel should be taken beyond the seas to people who know nothing about it at all.
And that's what makes him such a revolutionary figure, right? I mean, that's what makes him an extraordinary, groundbreaking figure in the late Roman world. Is that right?
It does. And I will quote again from Peter Brown, the great historian of the Holy Man in late antiquity. And he says of Patrick's originality, was it no one within Western Christendom had thought such thoughts as these before, had ever previously been possessed by such convictions. He's the first person basically to get the sense that barbarians living beyond the frontiers of the empire, that they should be brought to Christ. And this is, I think, a kind of momentous development, because it means that the Irish church, as it comes to flourish and grow, is committed to the idea that missions should be sent.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, how the Irish saved civilization. That's the, you know, how Thomas Cahill in his book frames it.
Yes.
The impulse for Irish saints to go into exile, you know, whether that is to Skellig Michael, this kind of remote island off Ireland, which you'll know is in Star Wars.
Yeah. In the right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or to like St. Brendan, to take ship and go out into the Atlantic and discover perhaps new worlds there.
I was about to say, didn't Irish missionaries go to Iceland?
Go to Iceland, perhaps, yep. And of course, famously, St. Columbanus goes to Gaul and establishes a kind of great missionary tradition there. And St. Columba, he goes to Iona and establishes, he starts the kind of the process of bringing Christ to the Picts, but also to the Angles of Northumbria. And that kind of sense of the missionary tradition becomes an important part of the Anglo-Saxon church, and then in turn inspires Anglo-Saxon missionaries to go to Saxony and to Germany and to Scandinavia. So it is, I think, a kind of... Patrick is, for that reason, a really significant figure.
Okay. Tom, I think we should take a break, because while you've been talking, listeners may be wondering why I've been quite quiet. That's because you've been talking about St. Patrick and I've been basically devoting my attention to my free beers from Beer 52. So I've just finished my Oh Brother Brewing Company Milk Stout, which I have to say, Tom, was delicious. Very rich, velvety, a lovely drink. And have you been getting on while you've been chatting?
Well, I haven't had a chance because I've just been jabbering away.
Oh, that is poor. But you've really missed out. What folly.
But if we're going to for a break now, I can have a quick sip.
Well, listen,
in the commercial break, and then crack
before,
on
before you
half.
Do that, Tom, I think it would be remiss of me not to say to people that if you want to taste them for yourself, you should go to beer52.com/Ireland to claim your free case. And we will be back after the break with more on St. Patrick and some more on the beer. Goodbye.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot,
Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. And as if you didn't know, sponsored this week by Beer 52. Now, Beer 52, I know you all want to hear a lot more about Beer 52 and probably less from Tom about St. Patrick. Beer 52 is actually the biggest beer club in the world. And every month they send their members a case of beer from a different part of the world. And wouldn't you know it, for this month, being St. Patrick's Day, it is Ireland. Tom, have you chosen your beer for part two of the podcast?
I have, Dominic.
What is it?
It's an Irish lager from O'Hara's Brewing Company.
A fine drink, Tom. I heartily recommend it. I had that while you were talking about pirates and Christianity and stuff.
It has watered my tonsils.
Splendid.
So that I'm now able to continue with St. Patrick.
So that's beer52.com/Ireland. And that's the word beer, the numbers 52.com/Ireland. So now on to the other business of the podcast, which is St. Patrick. So let's talk about the kidnap, because you hinted in the first half that the kidnap by the pirates, that there may be more to that than meets the eye. And indeed, Tom, shockingly, it may not have happened. So what's going on?
This is the thesis of Roy Fletchner, whose book St. Patrick Retold is really fantastic.
Yeah,
and fizzing with all kinds of brilliant
fizzing
insights
like
and
a,
theses,
like a
fizzing like a New England IPA or an Irish lager from O'Hara's Brewing Company. Exactly,
brilliantly done.
Yes,
please keep these promotional inquiries coming to other companies.
And he asks, was Patrick really kidnapped?
Right.
So the context for this is that there is a lot of kidnapping and slaving going on.
Yeah.
I mean, no one questions that.
Yeah.
We have in Roman historians, you know, there are accounts of kind of meltdown in Roman Britain, and Irish raiders are part of the kind of consortium of Picts and Saxons and all these other guys who are kind of breaking into Roman Britain. So we absolutely know that that is going on. We also know that there are so many slaves in Ireland, that the word for a slave girl becomes a kind of, you know, it comes to denote a unit of value in exchange. So
what is it?
A cumal.
Okay.
I hope that
it's probably pronounced completely
Gaelic
different.
Speakers will, yes.
But to be
I
fair,
know.
You're on your sixth beer of the podcast. I mean, you can be excused.
I'll be absolutely fluent in it by the end. To that extent, it's, you know, it's entirely plausible that Patrick might have been taken. However, you know, we looked at the implausibility of the fact that he might, you know, did he really manage to walk 200 miles to a ship?
You know,
but again, you could say maybe, or maybe, as you said, it's a kind of, you know, it's a biblical illusion or whatever. The theory that Fletchner puts forward in his book, he goes back to look at the role that Patrick's father is playing in the curia, in the kind of the town council of wherever this place is that he's growing up. And he points out that there were a lot of kind of civic responsibilities, a lot of weight put on the shoulder of those with land and property and slaves and possessions that kind of obliged you essentially to contribute your time and your money to caring for the city. And that in the kind of the dying days of the Roman Empire in the West, quite a lot of the elites got fed up with this and tried to kind of wriggle out of their responsibilities. And his thesis is that actually what Patrick is perhaps has done, and perhaps what he's justifying in the Confessio. So he keeps kind of emphasizing again and again, I was kidnapped,
right,
kind of implying that people have been saying, well, maybe you weren't. Fletcher's argument is that perhaps he was a tax exile. So just before he becomes 16, when he comes of age, perhaps he took, you know, his inheritance and went to Ireland and hung out there for 6 years.
God,
and then the Roman Empire collapsed and then came back.
I thought I was being cynical in this podcast, but I mean, that's a very, very cynical view of St. Patrick's behaviour, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite.
What do you think? Do you buy that argument?
I think the problem with that is that it absolutely requires Patrick to have been born at a time when the frameworks of Roman rule are secure enough that you get in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, that the whip hand of central Roman government is pretty strong.
Yes.
Which then requires you to push Patrick's birth perhaps to, you know, I don't know, 380 or something
right,
like that.
Right, further back into the fourth yeah. century. Yeah.
And there's kind of further, you know, there are kind of other pieces of evidence within the Confessio that suggest that actually Patrick died kind of certainly second half of the fifth century. So it's tricky.
It requires Patrick to have been very cynical and self-interested early in his life and then to have this miraculous transformation into a much more altruistic figure later on, doesn't it? I mean, that's not impossible, I suppose.
That's not impossible. And that, of course, is, you know, the archetype of that is Saul,
yeah.
who persecutes the church and then becomes, as St. Paul becomes the kind of the great missionary.
Or Augustine, I suppose.
Yeah, or Augustine. But Paul perhaps is the obvious example because he's the great missionary. So he's going out in converting those who know nothing about Christ.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, the truth is we will never know.
Okay. Well, that's a very depressing thing to say in a history podcast. But Tom,
I don't think it is. I don't think it is because I think the fact that it's the fact of what we do know that's exciting. You know, as I said at the beginning, because otherwise we know nothing about this period. We have no written sources written by someone from Britain at all
okay.
from this period. So that's what makes it so exciting.
Let's push on a bit, Tom, because I'm keen to get back eventually to the beers. Patrick dies when, do we reckon? You say that basically the second half of the 5th century, or is that too late?
Well, we're given two dates in right. subsequent chronicles. Yes. One is 457, one is 493.
Okay. I mean, so, that's quite a big...
You know, you pay your money, you take your choice.
Okay.
And of course, it's perfectly possible that neither of them are correct. But what
indeed.
That does suggest is that the tradition is that he died in the second half of the 5th century.
Does that imply there could be two different people, though, again, that died in those 2 years? Or do you
possibly.
Think that's
so that's so that, that is the thesis that maybe the first Patrick died in 457 and the second one in 493.
Yeah.
So that has been argued.
And then obviously after that point, he has this tremendous afterlife. So he does
yeah.
to go back to Tony Larkin's question, he does get the credit for introducing Christianity. He is seen as the kind of father of Irish Christian identity.
Well.
How does that, yeah, come on then. How does that happen?
Okay, he's one of two people who contest for that. Actually, the person who really gets, you know, in the Middle Ages is Bridget, who you fans of the World Cup of Gods will remember.
Well, they won't because she crashed out so early, Tom.
Yeah, she did. So St. Bridget of Kildare is Patrick's great rival as the kind of the alpha saint,
yeah,
the uber saint for Ireland. So Kildare is in South Ireland. Patrick is associated with Armagh in the north of Ireland, in Ulster. Again and again, when you look at the posthumous reputations of saints and indeed of holy men, so you could say the same about Muhammad, it really matters the places that they're associated with because the posthumous holiness that they shed gives power and authority and prestige to these places, and they become centers of pilgrimage. The authority of the person who may have founded the church or, you know, the mosque or whatever becomes incredibly important.
Yeah.
And essentially what the monks of Armagh are doing is bigging up Patrick in almost every way they can. So there is a slight problem that he's not buried there. He's buried at Downpatrick.
Yeah, County Down.
And so they have to come up with a reason for why he's there. And so they say that he was in Armagh. He died there, but then the angels took his body to Downpatrick. And of course, the people in Glastonbury would say that he died in Glastonbury. So,
yes.
You know, there is this kind of, you know, it's like Greeks fighting over the bodies of the dead before Troy. People, it really matters where these saints end up. Anyway, so it's a problem that he's not buried Armagh, but not an insuperable one. The monks of Armagh produce certainly two biographies of him from the late 7th century, so kind of 690s, that have survived. Now, the question is, of course, how reliable are these?
Yep.
And it's in these biographies that you get the accounts that most people will have heard of Patrick confronting Druids.
Right. Yes, I want to talk about this.
Yeah. So the High King of the Irish at Tara has a whole load of Druids around him. No one is allowed to light a fire at Easter. Patrick lights a fire. And the Druids look out and they say, unless this fire is extinguished, then verily I say unto thee, a fire shall be lit that will never be extinguished at all. Kind of words to that effect.
Wow, that's very Cranmer, Archbishop Cranmer, isn't it? At the Martyrs Memorial.
Well, I suppose. But actually, of course, what it is, it's Patrick confronting a posse of pagan sorcerers. It's Moses confronting the priests of, you know, Egypt in front of Pharaoh. It's Elijah confronting the priests of Baal. These are kind of archetypal stories with very, very obvious biblical precursors.
That's the problem, Tom, with all these sources, though, isn't it? I mean, this is the problem with all sources written in this period, or indeed earlier, that they all have ultimately kind of devolve into archetypes. And when you dig into the stories, it's very hard to tell what's specific truth and what is purely a kind of a formula.
It absolutely is. And so Caroticus, for instance, the Romano-British slave trader, one of these saints' lives written in the 690s says that he was a British king, that he ruled in Strathclyde, so presumably on the great rock of Dumbarton, the kingdom of Alclut. But if you're tempted to believe that as an authentic, an authentic report, you then face the problem that this life also says that when Caroticus died, he turned into a fox. So how you kind of integrate that into...
Yeah. Yes.
So it's a problem. There is perhaps one intriguing fragment of evidence that does preserve an authentic detail. And this was I read it on a blog post that's devoted to rude words.
Golly, you're
and insults.
Really, you're doing the absolute forensic research here, Tom.
And it's written by Vox Hiberionicum. Who has an excellent Twitter account, which I commend. And he gives this account of Patrick is sleeping on the Sunday, on the Sabbath, day of rest, and the pagans are busy working. I think they're digging a moat or something. Patrick tells him to stop. The pagans tell him to piss off. And then, and I quote, "Holy Patrick said, 'Mudderbroth, in spite of all your labor, you shall achieve nothing.' And so it happened. The following night, there came a heavy storm and stirred up the sea, and the storm destroyed all that the pagans had done, as the man of God had said." Now, what I read there in English is written in the original in Latin.
Yeah.
But Mudderbroth,
yeah,
that's not a Latin word. That, I gather, from is a Brittonic word. So that's the language that Patrick would have spoken as a Briton.
Yeah.
Apparently, Mudderbroth is a kind of jumble of various, of three Brittonic words, and I speak with no expertise whatsoever. I'm merely reporting what is written in this fascinating article, that it means may God's judgment be on you or may God's doom be on you. So perhaps that is an authentic patrician
sound.
Swear word or
all
exposition.
Right. Well, Tom, we're whizzing through. Time is kind of catching up with us. So I would like to get on to two more aspects in particular before we turn to the question of purgatory. One of those is snakes. Now, it's well known that St. Patrick cast the snakes out of Ireland, but I think I'm right in saying there never were any snakes in Ireland. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there's an excellent question from Huel George. Should Patrick be considered an ecological villain for reducing the serpentine biodiversity of Ireland?
But he didn't.
He shouldn't.
There never were any snakes.
There never were any snakes.
I'm not a natural historian, so I don't know why there were never any snakes, but there just weren't, were there?
Well, they never crossed the Irish Sea.
No. So... Who knows why not?
They couldn't swim.
Right. Okay. So that's the end of the snakes. What about the shamrocks?
Well, no.
Oh, you want to say something about snakes?
Well, no, it's just that the way that this legend grows up is interesting because it was noted by, Roman geographers noted that there was no snakes in Ireland. I mean, they understood that. And the legend that a Christian holy man had banished them, it's not original to Patrick. So it gets associated with St. Columba, I think, first of all. Bede reports that reptiles, full sweep, can't survive in Ireland, that it just kills them the moment they land there. And then the story seems to have originated around 12th, 13th centuries.
So much later. I mean, but basically almost 1,000 years later.
Well, even then you get skepticism. So Gerald of Wales, who is very skeptical about almost everything that the Irish say, he's very... very contemptuous of the whole idea. It is more probable that from the earliest times and long before the foundation of the faith, this island was naturally without them.
Okay, so now let's take the other great thing that people know about St. Patrick, which is that he waved shamrocks around to demonstrate the truth of the Trinity. Is this also untrue, Tom?
The earliest attestation is 1680s.
Yes, I saw that. So very late. So more than 1,000 years after the event. So almost certainly not true. So how did the shamrock come to be associated with St. Patrick? Or is it purely just a sort of creation of early modern stroke modern nationalism, would you say?
Yeah, well, so 1680s is obviously, I mean, you know, that's the backdrop is heightened Catholic-Protestant tension, particularly in Ireland. So presumably that is the context for it. It's Protestants and Catholics competing over Patrick.
And then this question about purgatory. I mean, I'm actually just reading that out off your notes, so I don't know what it refers to at all. I'm not going to pretend any knowledge.
Well, so in the Middle Ages, the story arises that this island in County Donegal is an entranceway to purgatory. Oh. And the story goes that Patrick was shown it by Christ himself. And this is, well, I mean, relative to the shamrock, this is quite early. So this is 12th century, late 12th century.
Yeah.
And pilgrims would go there. And there were kind of very, very detailed accounts of what people saw in it. And there's a brilliant account of this. This is how I came across the story in Stephen Greenblatt, the great Shakespeare scholar. He wrote a book called Hamlet in Purgatory.
Yeah.
And he writes wonderfully about this. And inevitably, I'm afraid it got shut down by Protestants.
That's
in
what I say, Thomas,
1632.
Thomas Cromwell would not be pleased with this story.
No, nor Oliver. So I think it is, I think the Franciscans run it today, but I think you can't go into the cave and look for purgatory. But that's another way in which the legends of Patrick has kind of woven itself into the flora and the fauna and the natural environment in Ireland.
And then if we sort of fast forward now, because we are quite close to the end, if we fast forward to the present day, St. Patrick and St. Patrick's Day has obviously become, as is so often the way, one of the great drivers for it is kind of Irish Americans. And so you have St. Patrick's Day parades among kind of Irish communities in American cities, from especially gathering strength in the sort of late 19th century and then throughout the 20th century, and obviously now completely institutionalized. And there is this sort of thing now that, you know, the Taoiseach will go to the White House and present the president with a bowl of shamrocks and all this kind of stuff, but also that a member of the British royal family will present the Irish guards with a bowl of shamrocks and all this kind of thing. But do you think, Tom, that this still has a kind of religious dimension? And in particular, do you think it also has a dimension of, I mean, it's odd, isn't it, that St. Patrick has become this symbol of Ireland and to some extent, I guess, of Irish Catholicism, of Catholic Ireland, when he wasn't Irish? I mean, that's a kind of strange thing, isn't it?
Well, I think that that's what makes his story so, I mean, it's one that people can absolutely adapt. So obviously, one of the reasons why Patrick's Day becomes so important in America is that Irish people who have traveled across the Atlantic to the New World are, you know, they're immigrants.
Yeah.
Just as Patrick was.
They've kind of reenacted his voyage from Britain to Ireland. Yeah.
Exactly. And actually, in 2017, when Enda Kenny went to Patrick's Day to the White House and Trump was in the White House, and Kenny very pointedly said that St. Patrick is the patron saint of immigrants. Nudging Trump in the rib. So I think that that's kind of very helpful. I think, yes. So Patrick is claimed by both Catholics and Protestants. So Armagh, you know, the great cult center of Patrick is it got taken over by the Church of Ireland.
Yeah.
I think that in the late 19th, early 20th century, he obviously became associated with Irish nationalism and therefore with the kind of the Catholic strain of that. So that's also very much a kind of part of it. So it becomes a national holiday in Ireland in 1903.
Yeah.
You know, on the prompting of an Irish nationalist MP.
MP, in, yes, I remember. Yeah,
Westminster. Yeah. And but also they specify that the pubs should be shut on that day.
Well, there's always been a slight tension.
Well, it might encourage that.
There's always
I think it's only kind of early 1960s that they're finally legally allowed.
That's right. There's always been that tension between the purely Christian kind of Catholic observance of St. Patrick's Day, but also what is obviously worn out in the long run, which is the sort of hedonistic, the very what you might I suppose call the Irish American kind of St. Patrick's Day, which is all about kind of drinking and partying in the streets and wearing green hats and sort of stuff.
Irish beer, orange beards.
Orange beards, which a lot of Irish people actually find quite offensive.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing, isn't it? There's sort of the chasm between Ireland and Irish America. I remember once when I lived in Minnesota going to, they had an Irish shop in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was all orange beards and pictures of leprechauns and stuff. But also the kind of very Catholic kind of the crosses and that kind of imagery and the sort of combination of the two things. But I sort of wondered even at the time, what would a visitor from, 1990s Dublin make of this sort of kitsch side of their own national identity?
Well, I'm sure it's not a coincidence that the kind of the transformation of St. Patrick's Day into a kind of bacchanal has coincided with the collapse of the Catholic Church as the source of kind of prestige and morality within Ireland. And I think that also quite a lot of the stuff about the Druids, the stuff about the snakes, if you're kind of new agey, if you're into, leprechauns, let's use leprechauns as a kind of shorthand for the idea of Ireland as a mystical land haunted by spirits, then actually Patrick is a faintly sinister figure because he banishes them.
Okay.
So I think there's kind of interesting tension there.
Well, Tom, I think we should just end with the Bacchanal for obvious reasons.
Let's go to the Bacchanal.
Because I'm curious to know how you've got on with your free beers from Beer 52.
What is it? It's now kind of 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'm going to just go.
I mean, that's normally the time
the crate.
Where I start drinking anyway, to be honest with you. I've done the case now. I was doing it while I was polishing it
off.
How
many have you had?
Eight.
but you can, I think you can, looking on the thing, you can actually order 10 if you want.
I'm going to order another case, actually. I enjoyed it so much. So
which you can do with the special offer, right?
Yeah, you can. Well, you can claim your free case. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing. I've had my free case, so I'll probably buy another one. But listeners will be able to claim a free one at beer52.com/Ireland. That is beer in the numbers 52.com/Ireland. And Tom, the amazing thing is they'll only need to pay for the postage, which is £5.95.
Beer 52 are the world's biggest beer club. They'll send you a case every month, and it's much, much, and I can absolutely vouch for this, much more enjoyable than the bland mass-produced lagers you might find in the supermarket.
There's no comparison.
Isn't that right, Dominic?
There's no comparison
at all. And if dark beer is not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. And also included is an island-themed ferment magazine and a couple of snacks. And the snacks are excellent too. I might have them for lunch. And if you're not enjoying it, which you absolutely will enjoy it, you can simply pause or cancel anytime.
So that is beer52.com/Ireland. And people who listen to our Dickensian and Christmas Carol themed podcast will know that I shall be saving a glass for Tiny Tom. And on that note, we wish you a very happy St. Patrick's Day and goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.